What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, for years, an EPA official fought to protect American consumers from toxic chemicals found in everyday products. She was opposed by a doctor inside the chemical industry who saw it as overregulation by the federal government. How the shifting powers of these two women tell the story of the Environmental Protection Agency under President Trump. It's Tuesday, October 24th. Eric Lipton, you've been investigating the EPA for months. Can you tell me what happened to Kevin Hartley earlier this year?
Kevin Hartley was a 21-year-old from Tennessee who was working on stripping a bathtub of its paint surface using a chemical called methylene chloride.
As paint removers go, it's one of the strongest, methylene chloride, a chemical with a deadly history.
And while he was using the chemical, he collapses.
And was overcome by the fumes.
Goes into cardiac arrest, and he's found unconscious and unresponsive.
His brother kept his heart pumping until paramedics arrived.
And is rushed to the hospital and is declared dead.
When I received the medical records, Kevin's medical records, there was a reference in there to methylene chloride. After that, I just kind of started doing my own research to figure out exactly what this chemical is
using a chemical that you can go and buy at basically every home improvement store just about in the United States.
Why is this deadly chemical on the shelves?
It's sold every day, and for many, many years, the government and the manufacturer of the product have known that it is not only toxic, but potentially deadly, and actually dozens of people have died using it.
If it's on the shelf, to me, I feel like it should be safe.
But if this paint remover and this chemical are unsafe, why is it on the market?
It's because the federal government has never decided to take a regulatory action to say that despite the fact that there's a warning label which says that you must ventilate areas in which you use it, that this chemical is inherently dangerous enough, particularly for consumer applications, that it should not be used. And that is something that the Obama administration on January 19th moved to ban methylene chloride for paint stripping.
January 19th. That sounds intentional. That's the last day that Barack Obama is president.
That's right. I mean, it can't have been a coincidence. They must have spent months to prepare for this proposal to ban this chemical, realized that unless they did it before the end of the administration, it may not happen. And so they got it out the door on the day before the new president came into office.
So as of January 19th, was methylene chloride banned by the EPA?
No. What happened as of January 19th was the EPA announced its intention to ban the use of methylene chloride as a paint stripper. But it was only a proposed ban at that point. And the next administration was going to have to take the baton and to enact the actual ban.
So, Eric, before we get to what's happened during this changeover from President Obama to President Trump, can you give me a brief history of toxic regulation and the EPA?
In the 1960s and the 1970s, the American population became increasingly concerned about what was happening in the environment.
For several years, chemicals have been seeping into the basements of a number of houses, including this one. The evidence is always there.
The United States was suddenly developing all these chemicals that could transform society and make us more productive and efficient and prosperous. But what we gradually realized is some of these same chemicals, these inventions, were also poisoning us.
You could see the fear on some of their faces today as men, women, and children gathered for blood tests to determine whether those here have developed abnormalities.
I am really, really afraid.
In New York City, people were dying, literally dying from smog. The pollution was so bad. The rivers, like the Hudson River, were contaminated. In Detroit, the river was on fire.
The great question of the 70s is,
Shall we surrender to our surroundings? Or shall we make our peace with nature and begin to make reparations for the damage we have done to our air, to our land, and to our water?
Pollution had gotten to such a level in the United States that finally there was a swell of public opinion and an act by Congress to create the Environmental Protection Agency.
We still think of air as free, but clean air is not free. And neither is clean water. The price tag on pollution control is high. Through our years of past carelessness, we incurred a debt to nature, and now that debt is being called.
And so Congress passed a law that extended the powers of the Environmental Protection Agency to include oversight of toxic chemicals.
What is needed to cope with problems of this type is a law which would authorize EPA to require pre-market testing of chemicals and also to limit uses and distribution of those which are found to pose environmental or health risks. This urgently needed law would prevent dangerous chemicals from coming into widespread use in the first place.
And who helped push this original regulation in the 1970s?
So a young lawyer named Wendy Cleland Hamnett arrives at the EPA in 1979, and she is assigned to create the program which is going to approve new chemicals under the toxic chemicals law and see just what types of risk is associated with those chemicals and then approve them for introduction on the market.
So she's kind of there at the birth of all this.
Yes. And she stays at the EPA until September of 2017. She's there for 38 years.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Is there a moment or a presidential administration where the toxic chemical debate really comes to a head?
Mr. Speaker, Vice President Cheney, members of Congress, members of the Supreme Court and diplomatic corps, distinguished guests and fellow citizens.
During George W. Bush, there was a decision at the White House that the EPA needed to be restrained and that the scientists were spending too much time coming out with conclusions that were too conservative, i.e. protective of public health, and that they wanted a White House which was going to review the scientific conclusions from the EPA and make sure that they were reasonable and not resulting in unnecessary regulations. So that's when a woman named Nancy Beck, who had a PhD in environmental health from the University of Washington, this is a woman who grew up in Long Island, was hired to go to the White House and to help the White House. She was a toxicologist.
My name is Nancy Beck, and I've spent over 15 years working at the intersection of science and policy.
Previously, the White House had experts in the legal issues, the regulations, but now they were hiring their own toxicologists. The Bush administration decided, essentially, it wanted to second-guess the scientists at the EPA, and Nancy Beck was the person that was going to help them second-guess the scientists at the EPA.
So she is a regulator herself.
Yes, and she's, to some extent, has greater credentials than Wendy Hamnett has, who has a law degree and is not a toxicologist herself.
Precautionary regulations and policies are being presented as objective science when, in fact, they are not.
So we now have Wendy, who's been pushing for the regulation of these chemicals inside the EPA, and we have Nancy, who's overseeing the EPA because the Bush administration is skeptical that there's too much regulation of these kinds of chemicals. Why are we hearing about these two women in relation to one another?
During the Bush administration, they were in two relative positions of power.
I believe I would have first encountered Nancy around 2006.
Until last month, Wendy Cleland Hamnett was the top official overseeing pesticides and toxic chemicals at the EPA.
She worked at the White House in an office that reviewed agency regulations before they were published.
Which is literally what they do. They put a pen through the language that they don't like, and they send it back to the agency with red lines in it, and they say, this is what we think you should do. Anytime that you want to make a decision about a chemical, it comes down to costs and benefits and risk. And someone's going to have to make the determination of where is that line in which the risk is great enough that the government needs to act. And there's been tension between these two women over where that line is for over a decade now.
She's very professional. She's very knowledgeable. She just comes from a different place than I do philosophically, I think, on some issues, not on all issues.
If you had to distill, Eric, the differences in philosophy that we're talking about, or I guess differences in interpretation, what are Wendy and Nancy's opposing or contrasting philosophies?
Wendy's feeling on this is that there is no 100% when it comes to chemicals and risk, because you cannot feed humans asbestos and see how quickly it takes them to die. You have to go into this regulatory world with a certain amount of uncertainty. So you build your hypothesis with the best evidence you can, and then you make a decision based on that. But Nancy's position is that if the study is flawed and you can undermine the data that went into the study, then you need to dismiss certain evidence and remove it from the calculation, from what I've read in her testimony.
You know, the public trust is eroding in science. There are articles in the Washington Post about how 50% of the science that's published is, you know, maybe false and not true.
And a lot of what she does is to go and to sort of question the methodology in various studies, and which leads you to a place where the study is removed from consideration. And the net result often is either no action by the government or delay in action by the government. And to some extent, that's exactly what the chemical industry has consistently done. And that has been their modus operandi, which is to question the studies and to stop the regulatory action.
And I'm not saying every study isn't reliable, but if you want to have trust and confidence in your regulatory decisions, you need to be as transparent as you can absolutely be about that underlying data so that everyone is on the same page and can have a scientific dialogue. It helps to build trust and confidence.
I mean, she's a scientist and a toxicologist. I mean, if you are truly want to be rigorous about your science, then you're going to say this isn't good enough, you know, that there's a flaw in your argument here. And you're going to say, I'm not sure we can rely on this, and we need to question the data. And that's true. I mean, but the problem is that when it comes to toxic chemicals, there are not that many perfect studies. And so you want to remove bad science, but you have to do it carefully, because the net result can't simply be that all chemicals can be on the marketplace.
I think she would agree that EPA has a role in assessing risks from chemicals and taking action on those risks. I think her position might differ from mine in the degree of certainty that one might need to have, or the level of protection that's required.
It sounds like you're just describing different ways of assessing risk.
Yes, I think that's a large part of it. That's what she has focused on the most recent years of her career, is how EPA and others should properly assess risk.
And it feels like the bar for her is high.
Yes.
You know, there's a consistency to their differing. One of them seems to feel as if the government should err on the side of protecting health, and the other is that we should really need to be concerned about overreaching. And there has to be a balance between those two instincts in order to have the best possible regulatory system. But they represent two different worldviews and a tension that has played out for over a decade.
So then what happens?
So what happens is that by the end of the Bush administration, Nancy Beck became the focus of concern by public health experts in the United States. And they are quite concerned about the role that she'd been playing during Bush.
Mm-hmm.
She became a known entity as someone that was aggressively challenging EPA policy. So when Obama comes into office and Lisa Jackson becomes the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Obama appoints her. Lisa Jackson, along with one of her top deputies, goes over to the White House, and they tell the White House that we need Nancy Beck, you know, out of our hair, basically.
So with the dynamic changing inside the Obama White House, what happens to Nancy?
Nancy stays in the Obama White House through the first several years, but then leaves and takes a job with the American Chemistry Council, which is the largest trade industry group for the chemistry industry in the United States.
And presumably represents companies like the ones creating the chemicals that she and Wendy have been debating for years now.
Yeah, I mean, it basically largely comes down to the environmental groups and the American Chemistry Council when you get into the room and you're debating what should the rules be and which chemicals should not be restricted.
The legislation requires the Environmental Protection Agency to okay new chemicals before they enter the marketplace. Both business and environmental groups agree the previous law was too weak and needed that overhaul.
So there was a moment where all of the players suddenly reached the consensus that the federal government needed to do something on toxic chemicals. So suddenly you had the environmentalists and the chemical industry going to Capitol Hill saying, pass a new law. So Wendy is now on behalf of the EPA over there negotiating with the House and the Senate over language that everyone could agree upon. And Nancy is doing it now on behalf of the chemical industry. So they're, again, working together, but from different perspectives to try to settle on a new law. There was a moment where everyone came together and said, we can solve this problem. We can figure out how to have a society that benefits from chemicals but doesn't die from them.
So when it really looked like things were taking off with Congress and we were getting close to having a bill that would be passed and signed by the president, it was probably the most exciting experience that I had working at EPA.
You were proud of where this particular act was headed.
Yes, I was.
Did you actually imagine it saving lives?
Yes, absolutely.
We can keep families safe and unleash the engine of American innovation. We can protect the planet and keep creating jobs. If we can get this bill done, it means that somewhere out there on the horizon, we can make our politics less toxic as well. So this is a good day.
That was the biggest act by the federal government in 40 years on toxic chemical regulation.
And with that, I think it's time to sign. Let's do it.
What happens is that Congress in 2016 passes a law that significantly increases the Environmental Protection Agency's powers to regulate toxic chemicals. So the EPA now has these new powers, and it's charged with evaluating the 10 chemicals that are considered the most toxic chemicals in wide use in the United States. Mm-hmm. Methylene chloride was one of those top 10. And so it moved in January, days before the end of the Obama administration, to ban certain uses of methylene chloride.
So that brings us back to January 2017, right? Because it's that act by Congress that calls for the EPA to propose and then pass rules on how these chemicals will be regulated. And so that's what the EPA under President Obama proposes on January 19th, but they haven't passed it yet. So then what happens?
Like with many things in the Trump administration, the first thing that happened was things were stopped. And there were no new rules that they were going to adopt immediately. They froze, hundreds of rules across the federal government to begin a process of deciding just what do we want to do. And Scott Pruitt then began to build a team that was going to do this review for him. And among the people that he decided to bring in was Dr. Nancy Beck.
So after Trump's inauguration, Nancy Beck, who has been criticized for trying to weaken all this regulation and went to work for an industry trade group that was fighting these rules, is now back and at the EPA in charge of the future of this kind of regulation.
That's right. I mean, technically speaking, Wendy was her boss, but Nancy was hired under this unusual status called administratively determined position. So it's not a political appointment. It's not a career position. She was not supposed to be a manager, but she was acting as if she had authority, and she was, requesting and pushing significant changes. And Wendy and her staff felt that they had no choice but to agree.
So what ultimately happens to those rules that the Obama administration had proposed?
Nancy comes in, and she begins to hold meetings in Wendy's office at the EPA. It's a small room, and there's just a few people around the table. And Nancy is requesting again and again changes. And the thing that's pretty extraordinary is the changes she was requesting were exactly reflected in the testimony that she'd given and the comment letter she'd written on behalf of the American Chemistry Council. In a matter of weeks, she'd gone from pressing the agency as an industry corporate official to being in a position of authority to enact the specific changes that she had requested.
And is she getting them?
She is, yes.
How much did what was going on at the EPA, your interactions with people like Nancy, this new approach, factor into your decision to leave?
Working in the new administration did make it more difficult on a day-to-day basis to feel like I was enjoying what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
There were just lots of things going on that made the job very difficult. And I felt like I had done what I could do. And I thought it was time to pass the torch to other career civil servants who are going to be staying at the agency.
Finally, Eric, what do you make of where things ended with Nancy in power at the EPA and Wendy gone from it? What does that signify to you?
There's a generational change that's going on at the EPA right now. And I mean, what is happening now is fundamentally changing the EPA. The rule changes that went into effect, you know, and the way that the rule was rewritten is something that is potentially going to, you know, have consequences for years, if not decades to come, because these are the rules in which they set the priorities and then determine the process of risk evaluation for all of the toxic chemicals that are now going to be evaluated under the new law. So what's happening is big, and it's not just about Wendy and Nancy, but it's about federal chemical toxics policy for years to come.
So Eric, last week on the show, we talked about the state of the State Department, and the story had some really similar conclusions. Do you think that the reshaping of these federal agencies is in many ways the most significant thing happening under the Trump administration? It's just happening more quietly than, say, his executive actions and decision-making that seems to get a lot of attention.
No question that the regulatory and kind of structural changes that are happening at federal agencies is the most consequential thing so far in this administration. I mean, the pendulum has swung in the federal government and mm-hmm. the regulatory system in a pretty significant way. And regulations impact people in ways that they don't fully appreciate. And, you know, which toxic chemical is on the shelf of the store, you know, is being determined by these policy changes and these personnel changes at the EPA.
Eric, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Nancy Beck declined to be interviewed for this story. We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's what else you need to know today.
I urge you to think about what you put in your newspaper.
On yesterday's episode of The Daily, Bill O'Reilly cautioned New York Times journalists Emily Steele and Mike Schmidt against reporting on another story of sexual harassment allegations against him, saying it would be devastating to his children. In making his case, O'Reilly cited a recent tragic incident involving another former Fox News employee.
Eric Bolling's son is dead. He's dead because of allegations made, in my opinion, and I know this to be true, against Mr. Bolling. No game.
After the episode ran, Eric Bolling contacted Emily Steele with a statement. I believe it is beyond inappropriate for anyone to bring in the tragic death of my son, Bolling said. Just as Bill O'Reilly had wanted to shield his children from the allegations against him, I hope he will honor my request and avoid any future mentions of my son. My parting from Fox News was in no way connected to the tragic news of my son's passing. Several hours later, Bill O'Reilly apologized to Eric Bolling in a tweet. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.